When traveling to southern Utah for the first time, it is fair to ask, if the Red Rocks were cut, would they bleed?
Poet Terry Tempest Williams.
And when traveling to Utah's desert for the second or third time, it is fair to assume that they do, that the blood of the rocks gives life to the country. And then, after having made enough pilgrimages to the slick rock to warrant sufficient separation from society's oughts and shoulds, look again for the novice you once were, who asked if sandstone bleeds. Pull out your pocket knife, open the blade, and run it across your burnished arm. If you draw blood, you are human. If you draw wet sand that dries quickly, then you will know you have become part of the desert. Not until then can you claim ownership. This is Coyote's country, a landscape of the imagination where nothing is as it appears.
Terry Tempest Williams reading from her book of desert poetry and essays called Red. Steve Paulson asked Williams, why red?
Well, red is the color of blood. Red is the color of passion. Red is the color of the country before us. And my husband and I live in Castle Valley, Utah. It's in the heart of America's Red Rock Wilderness, just outside Arches and Canyonlands and the Colorado River, which is red. And it's hard not to have your irises and cornea and retina saturated with this color.
And yet for a lot of people, green is the color of life. I mean, if you think about a landscape, you often think about what is lush. It's the rainforest. It's vibrant with green. And the red of a desert would seem to be just the opposite.
It's definitely an acquired taste. And I can't tell you the friends who've come to visit, and they literally think they're on Mars. And that's a really good description. In fact, we were laughing because there's websites where they were saying that the landing on Mars was really the landing in southern Utah as a hoax. And, you know, it defies the color green. There's no question. And I find when I go east, as much as I love eastern landscapes, and I find I get claustrophobic after a certain amount of time because there is too much green.
You have a passage in your book where you describe the glory of red. And I'm wondering if you could read that for us.
Yes. Where I live, the open space of desire is red. The desert before me is red, is rose, is pink, is scarlet, is magenta, is salmon. The colors are swimming in light as it changes constantly with cloud cover, with rain and wind, with light, delectable light, delicious light. The palette of erosion is red, is running red water, red river, my own blood flowing down river. My desire is red. This landscape can be red. A flight of birds, a flight of words. Red-winged blackbirds are flocking the river in spring. In cattails, they sing and sing. On the riverbank, they glisten. Can we learn to speak the language of red?
Can we learn the language of red?
You know, that's the question I hold, and I think about it every day. I think red cries out for the body. Again, open the body and it bleeds. When one's in the desert, there's nothing extra. For me, it's how do we learn to live in place? How do we learn to speak a vocabulary that sustains us rather than depletes us? A language that focuses our energies, even in our own communities, rather than distracts us, which I think is so easy in the society of ours that moves on speed and noise rather than silence and solitude and slowness.
You know, for people who don't live in the desert, there's often this attitude, there's nothing there. You know, this is why you can dump waste there. This is why you can develop it to do whatever you want, because you're not really getting rid of anything. What is that about? Is it that people often don't see the desert?
Well, I think we have been the dumping grounds. I can tell you 25 miles west of where we live, there's 10 tons of radioactive waste sitting on the banks of the Colorado River, seeping into the watershed that eventually heads into the LA Basin. That's a very real fact. You know, if you go 40 miles east into the Cisco Desert, every day you can watch trainloads of nuclear waste being brought into the Utah Desert, transported through Moab, through downtown Moab, you know, right next to the schools, and on to Blanding, which is adjacent to the Navajo Reservation. So we are a dumping ground. These are issues. And I think it's because of what you said originally. We're not green. We're not populated. And so those people in Washington who are making these decisions, they look for a blank place on the map, and we're it. We certainly have a legacy of nuclear testing in the Utah desert. And my family have been amongst the downwinders. Even as we speak, Steve, my brother, is dying from lymphoma, which is a bloodborne cancer which has been traced to radioactive levels. 9 women in my family have all had mastectomies. 7 are dead from breast cancer. And I believe this is the legacy of hibakusha, or explosion-affected people, because of our perceptions of the desert, that it is a wasteland, that it is expendable, and nobody lives out here.
One of the things that I find most striking about your writing about the desert is how you equate this landscape with the human body. And you get pretty explicit about this. And you talk about the erotics of the desert.
I remember when I gave that book to my father, he just kind of put it on the table and put all of his magazines on top of it and just said, you know, I don't want to read about this. I don't want to hear about it. But how can you not be immersed in the desert, in the heat, in the water, in the sensuality of stone, and not feel that love? And I think it was a gesture in taking back our language. Eros, body, earth, no separation. Our body, the body of the land, it's the same thing. And I think perhaps if we see it that way, our body, the body of the earth, we would be less likely to exploit it. To me, it's about opening ourselves to the world around us and allowing ourselves to be vulnerable and to be changed.
You end your book with a prayer of sorts titled Wild Mercy. Could you read that?
Yes. The eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with hands clasped that we might act with restraint, that we might leave room for the life that is destined to come. To protect what is wild is to protect what is gentle. Perhaps the wildness we fear is the pause between our own heartbeats, the silent space that says we live only by grace. Wilderness lives by this same grace. Wild mercy is in our hands.
Where would we be without the desert, both environmentally and as a people?
I think without our deserts, we would forget that there is such a thing as silence in the world. I think we would forget what it feels like to have your eyes move horizon across horizon across horizon, to see that bitten landscape. I think without deserts, we would not appreciate abundance. Water. We are water. So maybe deserts are a reminder of what happens without water. So in the absence of life, we stand directly in the presence of life. Earth, rock, desert. I am walking barefoot on sandstone, flesh responding to flesh. It is hot, so hot, the rock threatens to burn through the callous soles of my feet. I must quicken my pace, paying attention to where I step. For as far as I can see, the canyon country of southern Utah extends in all directions. No compass can orient me here, only a pledge to love and walk the terrifying distances before me.
Terry Tempest Williams is the author of Red. Steve Paulson spoke with her.